Good evening and welcome to Bird Calls, made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at the 800-552-8502. Yes, this is a call-in tonight. You can call in with your questions at 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored over 70 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two young children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks for joining us again for the show.
Hey, good evening, Bill. Happy to be here.
Good drive up, I hope, all the way down there from the Nacogdoches area.
Yeah, it's so lush and green. I'm not used to August and September being so wet with rain and thus everything so green and lush. And there's good and bad to that. I think for the birds, of course, seed eaters and fruit eaters, there's a plentiful amount of food, insects as well, for our birds to eat. So rain is good. Has to be kind of like Goldilocks, just right.
Right, exactly. And you don't want to flood them out.
No, that's right.
Especially the ground-dwelling birds.
Exactly.
You know? So last month, we closed our show with our usual conservation tip. Can you go ahead and refresh our memories about our conservation tip last month?
It was one that we get a lot of eye-rolling and very cautious response towards something called fire. And a lot of our plant communities that a lot of our birds are dependent on require periodic fire. And so we talked about prescribed fire, so doing it at the right time, in the right place, and with a need. And so, but too many people fear fire and what it could do to our property and our structures like our home and barn and cars. And I agree, that's a problem. But if we want to have a lot of the wildlife that we cherish, we are going to have to realize here in the temperate zone, and I'm talking about much of North America, not just the listening area, many of the plant communities, many of the ecoregions, their fire is an integral part of it, just as integral as rainfall, sunshine, and soil. So I don't think anybody will argue those are important. Plants need rain, plants need sun, plants need soil, but many plants need fire. Not every day, not every week. Some areas it's a 3 to 5 year rotation, but it is very essential. And we profiled last episode to go with this conservation tip, we profiled the species bobwhite, the northern bobwhite, what we sometimes refer to as a bobwhite quail. And that species needs native grasses, and those native grasses need periodic fire. So if you're worried about the decline of bobwhite and eastern meadowlark in our grasslands and in our open forests with wild turkey and also bobwhite and Bachman sparrows, those all need periodic fire. So I hear you're playing the bobwhite. Let's listen. Everybody loves that one. A two-note bobwhite, mm-hmm. And that's the species we profiled last time.
So the fire, I was watching a documentary the other day about Yellowstone. And, of course, they have, you know, regular fires throughout the forest there. The fire comes in, burns off all of the top canopy, and then all of a sudden a lush field of wildflowers was blooming where there once was a small forest,
right,
you know, in that area. And that's the cycle of nature that it takes care of itself if you let it.
And in Yellowstone, it's easy to watch it happen, and it's easy to forget about it. But what we don't often do is go back and see how beneficial that fire was. But instead, we hear about fires in neighborhoods in California and elsewhere where it is a problem, mm-hmm, for home ownership.
Sure.
And it's dangerous, I agree. But a lot of those fires are in areas that are supposed to burn. And when we suppress fire, once there is an accidental fire or lightning strike fire or cigarette fire, boy, it's catastrophic. It's a problem.
The kindling is there, ready to go.
Yeah.
So this month, each month, we profile a bird. And what do you got for us this month?
Well, this one, we've got the species called a killdeer. It's often referred colloquially as a killdee. This bird's name does indeed end with the letter R. Their name comes from their call, which we're about to hear, and with a little imagination sounds like someone hollering, kill deer, or some abbreviated version like the rising D, D. Let's now listen to the call of the kill deer.
It's a real high-pitched, almost nasally kind of sound.
Yes, and we hear this all over the listening area. So out of 18 species that we've profiled in past episodes of this show, I'm excited that this 19th species is our very first shorebird. So a shorebird is a member of the bird order Charadriiformes, which includes sandpipers and plovers and phalaropes and curlews and lots more. And despite their name, not all of them, including the killdeer, are found only along the shoreline or water's edge. In fact, the killdeer, which is a type of plover, does like wetlands, but also can occur on dry-mowed sports fields, muddy areas trampled by livestock, or even large parking lots. Speaking of parking lots, ones that are lit up in our cities can attract killdeer well into the nighttime, as these birds will vocalize, they'll run around, and search for tasty insects that are illuminated by the bright lights. So the term shorebird is synonymous with the British birdwatcher term wader, but it's not synonymous with the American term wading bird. That term involves larger, huskier birds like herons and egrets and bitterns and allies. That's very different from a shorebird. So the killdeer can be found throughout the entire Red River Radio listening area, as well as the entire lower 48 states and much of Canada and Alaska. So it doesn't take long to encounter one. What you want to see on a killdeer, it has two thick black bands across its chest. We have a photo of one on the Bird Calls webpage. Go take a look at it. That photo was snapped by James Childress of Lufkin. In flight, they have a fiery orange rump. This rump patch is often seen when you get too close to the bird's ground nest or chick in summer, as the adults attempt to fake injury by hobbling away with that wing dragging on the ground. This behavior, we call it feigning. Let me spell that. F-E-I-G-N-I-N-G, feigning. And the idea is that the adult is pretending to be injured, which can lure away a potential predator or danger away from its helpless eggs or chicks on the ground. So a killdeer's eggs are speckled. They're laid directly on the ground in a nest, what is what we refer to as a scrape. And this is where the adults simply scrape a shallow, bare area amongst dirt and gravel, and then lay 3 to 5 eggs, but killdeer typically lay 4 eggs. Killdeer usually nest amongst pebbles or gravel like that found along a ranch road, or a driveway or a service road, or they'll lay eggs on a gravel parking lot or even a gravel rooftop, a flat gravel rooftop. So most of these locations, though, are obviously problematic since vehicle tires and eggs don't work well together. A recently fledged killdeer is tiny. It's super cute, resembling a fluffy wind-up toy running about. If you spot either the eggs, the fledgling, or a feigning adult, just turn around and give the bird some much-needed space and privacy. Like we said in a previous episode, remember the phrase, fish swim and play from 50 yards away. And that means give birds about 50 yards, about half the distance of a football field. And I know a lot of people will get a little closer, but don't get right up to them. When you're flushing a bird, you're obviously getting too close. They've got a little space issue they need. So if you see a feigning killdeer, enjoy the view, but tiptoe back and let them survive.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go to our first call tonight. Kevin from Shreveport, you're online with Cliff. Tell us what your question is.
Hi, Cliff. Big fan of the show. Huh. And this is kind of a mystery because it's a nocturnal sound that I hear. Often at times, I'll go out my back porch, and it also goes back to click and clack, where you have to describe the sound.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to describe what I hear.
Okay.
And it's never during the day. It's during the evening. We've had bats in our house. They've never made noise. But it's like chirp, 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 chirp.
Yep. And you actually are saying part of the critter's name, that chirp. This is not a bird. And we've profiled this before on the show, and it's great that you're bringing it up. I never get tired of re-profiling. Here it is. Listen here. And it's a chirp, chirp, and it's the Rio Grande chirping frog. So it's very it's very bird-like, and you nailed it when you said you don't hear it in the day. They're mostly at night. I've heard them in the day, especially in around rainstorms. But you're right. They're mostly calling at night, and it'll just drive you bonkers. You know, you're looking for this bird, and there's nothing there. And it's a tiny frog about the size of your thumbnail. And he's and he's sitting on a limb, a stem, usually just a few inches or a foot off the ground. He's not way up in the trees.
And he's calling to a friend. I can hear an answer.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you 100 yards away?
Right, right. And he's also calling to attract a girlfriend. So they're communicating for a reason. But this is a species that has moved into our area and has expanded because of the potted plant industry. And so when potted plants are grown somewhere else, like in McAllen, Texas, where the Rio Grande chirping frog is native, and those potted plants are then shipped in trucks or trains somewhere else and sold in stores, then this critter hitches a ride. And so it's something we didn't hear 10 or 15 years ago in our area. It's a fairly recent addition, and I agree, it drives me bonkers. I keep looking for a bird.
Yeah. I find it to be rather pleasant. My 9-year-old daughter finds it to keep her up at night. But two things to almost collaborate or with that is we just had new sod put in the backyard.
Uh-huh.
And also maybe another reason is I have a 20-foot by 10-foot pond in the backyard where we get a really loud frog that comes in there. I don't want to make that sound on the radio. It's really loud.
Yeah,
but that's interesting because I didn't think it was a bird, but I thought it might be something. I just don't hear it moving. You know, I don't hear it running around like so.
And when you get close to it, it just stops calling. It doesn't. Yeah. It just freezes where it is. It never moves like you say, but it just stops calling until your big Godzilla frame gets out of the way and stops scaring him. But I'm like your daughter. We open our windows in the spring and fall when it's cool. My cutoff is, I don't know, 68 degrees, I think. And so anything cooler than that is, you know, so 66 is perfect. And chirping frogs can still be calling. And I am annoyed by it because it's so irregular. So I like things that, like katydids at night, that just have a constant ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch.
Right.
But the chirping frog is irregular. He's just chirp, chirp, and then a pause, and then chirp, 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 and then a long pause. And so I'm staying awake going, well, when is he going to call again? How many notes is this one going to be? And I don't fall asleep. So I have to close the window when the chirping frog is outside our window. And they're usually very close to houses because they like our flower beds, and they do very well around our homes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that pond in our backyard helped spawn a good number of them, if you ask me.
Yeah, and actually the chirping frog's not using the pond for breeding. They'll use just a couple of droplets of water in the flower bed or cupped into a leaf or on the plant. So you've got a different species or two in your pond. There's several species it could be. So maybe Kevin, call back next time, get a recording with your cell phone of the other frog And we, even though this is a bird call show, we'll...
Yeah, I know.
So what you do is you call in and say, hey, I have this bird, but it's really a frog, and you know it and I know it, but it's how you can sneak your frog onto the show. How about that?
I don't want to sneak... frogs into the bird.
Okay.
Oh, we're okay with that. We like frogs.
Yeah, we like frogs.
Some of the birds like frogs too. So.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Hey, Kevin, thanks so much for calling.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. You can also submit, as Cliff just said, sound effects or photos of birds if you'd like us to identify them. Even the occasional chirper that might not be a bird is certainly usable on this show. And we did have a submission this time around from one of our listeners, and that was a listener named Dennis K. Gibson who sent in this particular audio. Listen for the background bird. The noise up front is just traffic noise and background sound.
Real fluty. Listen for the fluty sounds here.
And so what was that we were listening to?
That's a beauty. That's one of the most incredible bird songs that we have in the listening area. It's a spring and summer song. We won't hear it this time of the year. We won't hear it in the winter. They'll come back in April. This is the wood thrush. And old timers called it Eole. So that's the colloquial name because it sounds like it's going Eole, Eedaloo, Deedalee. And it's very flute-like. So the Eole, you know, if you're 89 years old, that's maybe how you learned it. It's a cool name. I love it. Very descriptive, but the correct ornithological name is the wood thrush, the common name.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. You can submit photos to our show at redriverradiomail@gmail.com. That's redriverradiomail@gmail.com or audio clips as well.
And when you say photographs, don't worry if it's the quality's poor. I mean, I don't want some that's super fuzzy, but don't think it has to be magazine cover quality.
Right.
And then same with the recording. That recording that just came in, it's maybe done with a cell phone. I don't know. And you know, it's not perfect. But it was good enough to air it on the radio here and good enough for us to identify what it is. So any kind of quality recording, send it in and maybe it'll get on the air. And then the photos Bill will put up on the Bird Calls webpage if we get any of those in. So, yeah, send stuff in even if you think, oh, this isn't going to make it.
All right, and we're going to go to our next caller now. We got Everett from Overton, Texas. Everett, what's your question tonight on bird calls?
I see these birds flying at night, and they fly up by the streetlights, and they catch these bugs flying right in the air, and they keep on flying. What kind of birds are those?
Those are.
And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay, well, at night around lights, it's probably common nighthawk. And nighthawk is a... It's a caprimulgid. It's related to whippoorwills and chuckwills widows. It's not a hawk. So nighthawk is one word. It's a very confusing name for beginners. They think it's going to have to be a raptor, but this is not. This is an aerial insectivore that flies around. Think of a purple martin in the daytime, and that's what this guy is doing at night, and that's the common nighthawk.
You are listening to Bird Calls from from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. All phone lines are open right now, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We are beginning the northern or southern migratory season, the time of year when the birds that we saw in the spring say, hey, the heck with this cold weather. We're going back down south. What are we expecting through the area right now?
And some of our birds have already started heading south, and this kind of causes a lot of concern because, you know, you have a lot of things going on this time of year. You have our breeders are leaving or maybe they're silent. The winter birds haven't been pushed in, and people often caller right saying, you know, the sky is falling, there are no birds. Well, it's that transition that we have in the fall that kind of, you just need to be patient. So there are still birds out there. They're going to come. But we've got some birds that have already been southbounding for a while. We mentioned the killdeer. A lot of the relatives of that killdeer, a lot of sandpipers, a lot of shorebirds have been moving already for the last 6 or 8 weeks, believe it or not. But right now we're almost to the peak of our beloved ruby-throated hummingbird southbound season. So they are really picking up in numbers right now. And the last half of September, they will really peak. That'll bleed into October, but it's all downhill after that. So by mid-October, they've really dropped out. And by the end of October, they're almost all gone. You just have a few wanderers or lingerers, what we call. But right now, I'd say enjoy the southbound migration of ruby-throated hummingbirds. It's something you can see quite readily. Put your feeder out, 4 parts water, 1 part sugar. Don't use the red dye in the feeder. We've talked about that in past episodes. They don't have red color dye in their diet. Why give it to them? The red is purely the neon sign to tell them, hey, we've got a feeder up. Well, buy a feeder with red parts. If that's not enough, put up a red scarf, a red rag. It can be orange or yellow, but put up some bright color that looks flowery colored up, and that's the neon sign to tell them, hey, here's a feeder. So, yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and our phone lines are open right now at 800-552-8502. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and he is ready to take your calls tonight. Again, call us in at 800-552-8502. All lines are open right now. And you mentioned the hummingbird feeder. Given that we've had such a wet, both spring and summer, with the other migratory birds, are we going to need to think about bird feeders for other birds, or would this just be too plentiful a food source to even worry about?
Yeah, I think a lot of people love to provide seed year-round. I don't look at it that way. I look at you know, the mid to late winter and an early spring. That's when food production goes down, and I'm talking about Mother Nature's food, and that's when your feeders really get hit hard. But yeah, right now there's so many fruits coming out for a lot of our fruit eaters. There's still a lot of insects, there's seeds. Mother Nature just provides a lot better tasting and a lot healthier food than what we can provide in a seed feeder.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. Give us a call right now at 800-552-8502, waiting for the next call to come through. In the meantime, what are the hot spots in this area? If I really wanted to see some of the migratory patterns and places where birds gather, where would I go for some of the different species to find out and get a good glimpse of them as they migrate
right
through the area?
Well, any of the, for shorebirds, any of the refuges or parks or WMAs that have wetland cells, and then those wetland cells need to be kind of drawing down, not full to the brim or overflowing, because shorebirds need mud flats or at least shallow water. So the local Red River National Wildlife Refuge would be a really good spot if you can get to edge of the river that might have some mud, or again a wetland cell that has some mud. In my area, the Alizan Wildlife Management Area, when those wetland cells down the middle road, when those get a little dry, that provides some really good shorebird habitat. So those I think are really good hot spots. They're also good for a lot of the wading birds. This is the time of the year to see wood storks and roseate spoonbills, and certainly, you know, the last 6 or 8 weeks has been really good for those too. And that those are birds we don't have breeding in our area, and this is the time when we would see them in July, August, September. So again, wood stork, roseate spoonbill, these are what we call post-breeding wanderers. that come up here into the listening area and spend the end of their summer and the early fall here with us.
This is their vacation time. We gave the kids life. Let's go have some fun.
That's right. Who would have thought that this part of the world would be vacation for somebody?
Hey, well, it's a wildlife paradise.
In the hot time of the year. So
give us a call at 800-552-8502. This is Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford. You can call in now at 800-552-8502. We have three calls online. We're going next to Kathy from Shreveport. Kathy, you're online. What's your question for Cliff tonight?
Hi, Cliff. I was just going to ask you about, I see red hawks, red-tailed hawks in our neighborhood, but I also see a bird with really pointed wings, and I just didn't know. Someone said it was a Mississippi kite.
Yes.
Is that what that is? Mm-hmm. Is there another similar kind of falcon-type bird that may be around that may be a little bigger with tufts? Like tufted hair on its legs, or is that the kite that I'm seeing?
No, the kite is very visible, very obvious, and it's like you describe, very pointed wings. They just float around on open wings. They rarely flap. They make flight look really easy, and boy, do they pour through our area starting late July, early August, and going into, you know, I haven't seen one in a few weeks, actually, a couple weeks. So, but any day in August, man, they are. I look up where I live in Nacogdoches, and I'll see three or four at a time, and so they also breed in a lot of the listening area. So some people will have them all through the summer, and so they just look gray when they bank, and you see the dorsal side. That means the top side of the back. On the top of the wing, they'll have a white bar on the wing, and I'll give a little flash of white or silver look to it, but otherwise they're just kind of a gray, sooty, ashy colored bird, and just make flight look easy. They're hawking for insects, so they're up there floating around looking for dragonflies, grasshoppers, moths, things like that, and they're catching them, because all of a sudden you'll see one just make this erratic maneuver. And he's dive bombing on something tasty, so my guess is a Mississippi kite. So
okay, well thanks very much.
Okay, thank you, Kathy.
Appreciate it.
Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Kathy from Nacogdoches. Kathy, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Cliff, I have a question about hanging the feeders for the hummingbird.
Okay.
I've got, at my house, it's just got one porch. And so am I better off hanging the hummingbird feeders all close together or separating them by just a few feet? Most I can separate them is about 3 feet apart, and there's always the bully that's keeping everybody away.
Well, first,
so how's the best way to manage that?
Okay, let's start with something different than the bully hummingbird. Let's look at the porch and how close it is to the windows. You don't want the feeder too close to your windows, otherwise you'll be causing, you know, unfortunate accidents. So is it pretty far away where you're talking about? You know,
it's about 3 feet away, but I've got the bird decals all over the window, and also I've got some other things that will break up the reflection to prevent the birds from hitting it.
Okay, those devices are pretty good. That 3 feet scares me a little bit, because if something spooks the birds and they don't have time to see the decal, you're going to have a dead or a stunned bird, and we think of stunned birds that come back and fly off as okay, but we don't realize a lot of them probably fly into the bushes and die later of severe internal injury. I mean, if you're a bird with hollow bones and you fly at 20, 30 miles an hour into a window, it's tough recovering from that. So I would say try to get a little farther away than 3 feet. Now, the bully hummingbird, and what we're talking about, for those people that don't know, is that there are certain hummingbirds that really try to capitalize on a feeding opportunity, whether it's a flowering bush or a flower garden or a hummingbird feeder. So what people recommend and what I'd recommend is to cluster your feeders pretty close together, three or four of them, because that bully hummingbird, he's going to have an easy time manning that one feeder. But when you've got three or four feeders clustered together, somebody's going to be able to sneak in and get a sip over at the other end. He's going to have a really tough time bullying the hummingbirds at a cluster of feeders. So cluster meaning three or four feeders. And you don't really need to run those the whole summer. It's really in the fall, or in the if you have a rufous hummingbird, and bird watchers out in West Texas have to deal with rufous hummingbirds a lot for several months of the year even. And so that's how they'll do it. They'll just run three or four feeders because the rufous hummingbird is one of the best known bullies of them all. And that's just how hummingbirds operate. There's nothing we can do about it. It's to protect a limited food source. So they're doing this in nature for a reason. There's not enough food going around. Well, that hummingbird with a pea-sized brain doesn't realize you've got 2 or 3 gallons of feed coming of nectar water maybe in these big perky pet feeders, and so he doesn't realize that it's almost an unlimited buffet, right? So the clustering might be good. Keep them a little farther from the windows, and I think you're in good shape. And also another thing with placement, don't put feeders of any kind too close to shrubbery where the neighbor's cat can hide and see all that action and activity, like Grand Central Station, that they'll see that at the feeder and they'll hide in the bushes and boom, pounce on the unsuspecting birds feeding. So those are a couple things to think about when placing a feeder. And then also just we got to make sure that we clean those feeders out regularly. Don't leave that food in. One of the misconceptions is I'm not going to change the food until, by God, they drink it all. You know, and that's a really bad attitude. If that's the case, only fill it halfway up or a quarter of the way up and replace it every 3 or 4 days and give the feeder a good cleaning. If it's a hummingbird feeder that's tough to clean, throw it away. Get a new one. There are lots of them out there that are easy to clean. Some of them are dishwasher safe. I don't know that many people with hummingbirds have time to wait for the dishwasher. Just do it by hand and do it quick. And don't use a lot of chemicals. Chemicals are harsh. Even a lot of soap is harsh. Just get it clean with hot water and some good elbow grease, and you should be in good shape.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
I'll move
Kathy.
My hummingbirds out to the trees.
Okay, good. Thank you, Kathy.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call, anything concerning our avian world and birding is welcome tonight, even chirping things that you may not think are birds. We're welcome. And we're going to go next to Terry from Cold Springs, Texas. Terry, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hey, how y'all doing?
Hey, Terry, how are you?
Good, good. Got a question. What is, I've got some old hummingbird feeders that are kind of dirty, but not that bad, but I take them apart. So you're saying just wash them like with Dawn or not?
I wouldn't use, I mean, just maybe a little drop of Dawn in a tub of water, really dilute it. And then just use some, you know, a scrub brush. But you know, a lot of people want to get, you know, heavy chemicals and bleaches and things, and that's just not a good idea. So, yeah, and when you say old feeders, you mean they just dusty, they've been set up for a while?
No, they actually, they got in the back of my, and one of my family members left them out, so they were rained in.
Uh-huh.
I mean, so they're just dirty. I need to clean them really good.
Okay.
But I do wash them. I wash them till they're like squeaky, squeaky clean, then I'll even take a clean brush and go inside. Because I know these little guys got to have everything as clean as they can.
Yeah, and it's just healthier that way. And that's good that you're doing that. So when I was thinking of old feeders, I was also thinking of feeders that leak. They might have a little crack.
No.
And good. That's good. It doesn't have that, because that's when you get into problems with bees and wasps. Anytime there's leakage, you've got bees and wasps capitalizing. Because guess what? They want that same sweet nectar. They're drinking the Kool-Aid too. So,
and I have 2 other things to ask if you don't mind.
Okay, no, go ahead.
The water to sugar ratio. I buy organic sugar, and I used it last year, and they just went ballistic. I mean, absolutely ballistic. Should I cut the sugar content back on that? Because it is a raw, natural, organic sugar.
No, I think if you're still working at the 4 parts water, 1 part sugar, you're fine. Some people do 3-to-1. That's okay. You don't want to make it any more powerful than that. 2-to-1, 1-to-1, that's just crazy.
Now, when you're talking about 3-to-1, you're talking about like cup per se?
Let's say we're using the cup. So use right. 4 cups of water and 1 cup of sugar.
Okay.
Get that water hot. If you want to boil it, that's fine. Just don't serve it while it's still hot. That means you're going to let
right.
it sit on the kitchen counter for, 3 or 4 hours till it cools off, or maybe longer.
And that was my last question, because when I was a kid growing up, my mother always had the best tea in the neighborhood, and the reason being because she always boiled her water and sugar together to make sugar water.
Yeah.
And that's what I do also, some of the feeders. But, I serve it cold or room temperature, so... But that's a better thing to do, too, as well as melt that sugar beforehand instead of just putting there and stirring it.
Yeah, I just, you can see it melt when you boil the water. You can see the granules go away, and it turns kind of a syrupy look, and then if you keep stirring, it's gone, and it's just
right.
clear again.
And
I don't see that when I just use tap water, but I know a lot of people... We'll just use tap water, especially in areas like Southeast Arizona or the Davis Mountains of West Texas, where you've got a lot of hummingbirds and you don't have a lot of time. But here in Shreveport, or in your case, Cold Spring, or my case, Nacogdoches, I got lots of time. I can plan ahead. I can brew it. I brew my own iced tea. And when I see it getting low, I'm brewing a batch so I don't go without.
That's what I do as well.
And you do it with your hummingbird nectar, too. When you see that your little jug in the fridge is going down, brew a new batch, and it'll be ready for the next day because it will have cooled off.
And one more thing, and I'll get off the phone. I did not know that Oreos – I had some Oreos last year that came to my feeders.
Yeah.
And I didn't know they did that. That
yeah. I mean, they love that sweet tea. I mean, everybody loves sweet tea, right? So
right.
So the Orioles like the nectar. Woodpeckers will come, too. As well, and we mentioned bees and wasps, but those are the main birds, orioles and woodpeckers, and sometimes house finch. And if the bird is small and light, they're fine. People don't get too upset. But when it's a heavy bird and they tilt the feeder and then it spills out all over the floor on the patio and then the ants come all over the place, that's a problem. So they do make an oriole feeder that's a little bit more supportive for the oriole. I think it's cool. When you have a male Baltimore oriole at your hummingbird feeder, that bright orange and black is so awesome. Yeah, I think it's cool.
That's the first time, and I'm hoping they'll come back. I hadn't seen them this year so far.
Yeah, they're pretty much migrants in our area. They're a very, very local breeder, very local, very hard to find the breeding season, but not unheard of at all in the spring and fall migration. They actually pour through here in big numbers, and that's when you can see them is at your hummingbird feeder, and he's not a big hummingbird. He just likes that Kool-Aid.
Well, thank you for being out there, and thank you for answering my question.
Thanks, Terry. Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open and are ready for your call. We're going to go next to Kim from Jefferson, Texas. Kim, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
I just have something amusing to tell you, but and also a question. I just wanted to say that my husband and I, when we were dating, our first date was bird watching. We love it, and we enjoy your show, too.
Oh, cool.
But, that was neat. But my question is, what kind of educational background do you need to be an ornithologist?
Well, you need to go to college and start off with a bachelor's degree. You can get it in any of the related fields of wildlife or biology or ecology. Or forestry, but then a master's degree is going to be really helpful, and then oftentimes a PhD. So, if you're 19 and asking, you got a lot of time, and this is a perfect time to ask because the schooling is going to take a while. But I don't know how old you are, if this is actually a serious question for yourself, but. If you're 40, there's nothing wrong with going back to school and learning this stuff, especially if you're not looking to get a job in this field, but just learning, having something to do as the next stage in your life. But But they're just not, they're not a lot of jobs. I mean, I know a lot of ornithologists or people that specialize in birds, and the two big employers, in my opinion, are school teachers and environmental consulting firms. That's where I see most of my buddies go. And then third would be a federal or state agency like the one I work with, Texas Parks and Wildlife. They'll hire biologists. Sometimes it's not a bird biologist position. It might be something more general, maybe an outreach specialist or a game animal biologist. But you still, it never hurts to have a specialty in birds, because I'd like to think that birds are always going to come into your life no matter what you're doing with birds. I mean, with biology or with ecology. Yep. You're gonna attract birds. You're going to see birds. You know, if you were a mammalogist, you know, other than the obvious stuff like a squirrel or a deer, you know, the bats and the rodents, and I'm not talking about nasty non-native rats and mice. I'm talking about the really cool stuff. All that stuff's nocturnal. And so I would think mammalogy is a really tough field. I'm not saying it's a bad choice. It's just to see stuff that's really cool, like the diversity of bats and rodents, you got to be up at night. You got to have the graveyard shift like Dracula to see a lot of these things. But birds, I mean, they're everywhere, no matter what field you're in the outdoors. Even people that are doing landscaping are going to encounter birds and can do things good for birds in backyards. So if you're interested in birds, I would say think about other aspects like the one I just mentioned about landscaping. I mean, there's a great need for people out there that are willing to put in native wildscapes, native meaning native species of plants for birds. And I would think that, you know, that would be really a great profession for somebody. And we need it. And the big cities like Houston and New Orleans, and Dallas and Shreveport, where you got a lot of people, you're going to have enough clientele to keep you pretty busy, especially if you're able, I think with small businesses, if you're able to get through that first 5 or 10 years, which is a long time, but I think you could see business really rolling in if you've got good word of mouth and you do a good product. So I would think that would be a good position, and you'd have ornithology as your foundation. I thought that's great that you said that your husband and you started. Was it before you married that you started going birding? You were dating, you said?
Yeah, we met online, and our very first date was going bird watching.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That is a love story right there. I like that
it
one.
Is. Yeah, absolutely.
I like that.
Much.
I like that. Hey, thanks, Kim.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Kim. Literally a love story for the birds.
That's right.
Give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. If you have a question for Cliff, this is Bird Calls, our resident program about ornithology and birding. And tonight we are taking your calls with Cliff Shackelford, who is our resident ornithologist. We do have a question that came in online, and that was the listener wanted Cliff to discuss the difference between different kinds of feeds for birds and the kind of birds that they attract, i.e. sunflowers versus some other kind. What are, you know, if you're trying to attract a particular species of bird in our area to your backyard, what are some of the kind of different feeds that they tend to gravitate towards?
Well, I'm going to just cut to the chase. The one that works the best on the most variety of species is the black oil sunflower seed. Black oil sunflower seed. It's readily available. It attracts a great diversity of seed eaters. It doesn't have a lot of fluff in it. So fluff meaning millet that you'll get from these mixtures of birdseed, where part of it is the black oil, but a lot of it's filler. It's kind of like when you buy these mixed candies and you really like the M&Ms in that trail mix, but there's just only a few of them. Well, if you really like M&Ms, just get the M&M pack, right? Don't worry about the peanuts and the cashews if you don't like those. So same thing with the birds. I think go right to the black oil sunflower, put that in a feeder, you'll get the most variety. Now keep in mind, a lot of people put these seeds out thinking, oh, I'm going to feed the robins, I really like the mockingbirds. Those two don't eat seeds. They're not coming to your seed feeder. So it's going to work on things like goldfinch, cardinal, titmouse, chickadee, blue jays, things that will eat seeds. So think about what you're trying to attract. And I don't really want to go through all the different seed choices, because another one that people love but is very expensive is the thistle. And a lot of people want to invest in paying the higher dollar for thistle and putting that in the thistle sock, and you get siskins and goldfinches, and they really like those thistles. But if you don't want to spend a lot of money, I wouldn't recommend thistle. But black oil sunflower is the way to go.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we'll take your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question about birds, birding, or your backyard, and how to attract more birds? All of these questions are game, and also conservation questions as well. Again, that's 800-552-8502. We go next to Brenda from Nacogdoches. Brenda, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Oh, thank you. I was looking for further clarification on hummingbirds and their food. Cleaning the feeders, I just barely caught something about not using bleach, and I had heard not to use soap, but to use bleach and rinse well. I have a lot of trouble with mildew and mold.
Yeah, I was saying to lay off the heavy chemicals and the harsh soaps and use more elbow grease and hot water. And that's
even for mold.
If you have mold, you can scrub that off with a toothbrush or a pipe cleaner. You might be sitting there for a couple more minutes, but you know, if you're going to use bleach, I would recommend that you let it sit out for a long time to dry, and not just the moment it dries, but a lot longer than that. So you're looking at more time that the feeder's not up for the feeder if you're going to try to do the bleach route. Instead, use the elbow grease and get it done that way.
And I also caught tail end of about storing the – I always make the food fresh.
Right.
And use it, but you can store it in the refrigerator?
Yes, you can make it by the quart or the half gallon maybe. And store it in the fridge for a few days. It will keep, you'll know when it goes bad. It gets really syrupy, thick, and it can
cloudy.
Get some, yeah, it gets cloudy. And so if you want to have some, like this time of the year is when I'd recommend having some on hand, because so many hummingbirds are coming through and you're replacing it so much, and you might have...
Yes, it's getting tedious.
Yeah. And if you've got a day job like most of us, or you have kids like most of us, you don't have time to become the, you know, the servant of these hummingbirds, even though we'd like to think we are. I think it's good to be a servant of a hummingbird, but make it easy on yourself. I mean, we're doing that with raising our own kids. We make it easy. We buy milk by the gallon, don't we? We don't just get it one cow at a time, or one serving at a time. So you can do that with a hummingbird feeder. Yeah, make it in batches.
I just had heard the tail end about the bleach, and I usually do like a 10% solution and soak them and then dry them. I have several feeders I rotate through. So.
Okay, well, if you're rotating,
I'll lay off the bleach now.
Yeah, and that's a good, and thank you, Brenda, for calling, but that's a good point where Bill is he's going to have a podcast of this up. So if you do catch the tail end of something, starting sometime tomorrow, early in the morning, you can probably catch the podcast of this very show, as well as all the others that we have.
Right.
This is our 19th episode, and that means you've got hours and hours of fantastic radio listening, right?
And it is. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yep. Thank you, Brenda.
You are welcome, and you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call now. All phone lines are open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. When do the larger birds like sandhill cranes and others come passing through this area? For those, you know, who really like to get out to the wetlands and follow these birds. Sandhill crane, we had lots of them in Florida, so I love to go out and spy them when they're coming through.
Yeah, and sandhill cranes, if you live in central Texas, they pour through, and I'm talking about the I-35 corridor. And they'll end up on the coast, the central coast or South Texas. They're in the panhandle of Texas. We're kind of in a crane-free zone. They don't like the forests. Now that doesn't mean they're not going to be here. They're here, but in small numbers. They're not common. So, how about let's think about waterfowl, because those are larger. Those use wetlands, and they will start coming through as things get colder to our north. So, starting in October and into November, we'll get a huge influx of waterfowl. Now, there's a species, as we know, duck hunters know this one, the blue-winged teal. He's rather different. That species migration is weeks and weeks before any of the others start peaking. So the blue-winged teal start coming through around end of August, 1st of September, and then deep into September. But that's still a month or 6 weeks before a lot of the big ducks. Now, don't call saying, well, I once saw a gadwall in with a bunch of blue-winged teal. Well, you did. You saw one. But I'm talking about if you want gadwall numbers, and I'm talking hundreds and hundreds, it's not going to happen until about 6 weeks after blue-winged teal come through. So I think, and the thing I like about ducks is they're larger. You mentioned larger birds. They're easier to identify. The males especially. The females are tough, like the teal. The female teal are really tough, but the males, when they're in breeding plumage, and that's typically the time that they get, the big ducks get here in the winter, they're typically finishing up their molt, and they're usually in prime condition. Now, the blue-winged teal, when they come through, most of them, and I'd say 90-something percent of them, are not in breeding plumage. They look pretty ratty. The adult males don't have that crescent. And a lot of them are first-year birds. Those are immature birds. This is their first time to make this big migration. So I would say when things get colder to the north, you'll know, and we'll start getting our long sleeves out and jackets. And that means farther to the north, and that's where the source of a lot of our birds are. And we know this from, thankfully for the duck hunters that have duck bands on the birds they collect, they submit the data, we can then find out where a duck ended up. And so that duck that was maybe shot on the coast of Louisiana, we know was banded as a nestling up in Saskatchewan. So most of our ducks are going to be flying the Central or Mississippi Flyway for this listening area. For me, in Texas, most of my birds are what we call the Central Flyway. And these are very imaginary. There's no rule that these birds have to go in a certain flyway, and people think flyways are as narrow as an interstate, and they're not. They're huge. I mean, the Central Flyway is almost the width of Texas. It's just a gigantic flyway. So anyway, back to your question, I'd say waterfowl, as things get cooler, and it's a lot of fun. A really good place in the Lufkin Nacogdoches area is the Ellen Trout Lake. That's where the next door to the zoo in Lufkin, and that lake has been a really good spot for seeing all kinds of waterfowl, you know, 10, 12 species at a time. We have a couple of Audubon members that go there, namely Louis Debatez and Les Stewart and others. They lead field trips irregularly to that spot. I would say go to the Piney Woods Audubon website and see if they've got, or actually Les Stewart manages the Facebook page for Piney Woods Birds, and he'll put post on there when they're leading a field trip. But those ducks, they're not pressured there on Ellen Trout Lake. They get very used to humans, and they're not skittish, and they're still wild, but you can see really great views of again, 10 or 12 species right there. So that's a really good spot to look for ducks.
And a couple of quick questions. You already answered this one, but a listener missed it, and that would be, when is the last part of the hummingbird migration season for this area?
For our area, that's going to start in the month of October. The first week or so of October is still pretty good. The middle of October, boy, it's slow, and by the end of October, it's pretty much done.
And how about hawks, northern hawks? Do they actually, they come down here?
Yeah.
What time of year do they come?
We have a lot of hawks that'll pour through here right about now, and in the next week or so, we'll have a big push of broadwing hawks. And those are really tough to see because they're often little tiny pepper flecks way up high, and if you're not pointing your binoculars up there as you're standing on a hilltop or rooftop, you're not going to see them. And, you know, if you're lucky enough to go to a hawk watch tower in Texas, we have the closest one is at Candy Absher Wildlife Management Area. It's near the town of Smith Point. If you don't know where that is, Chambers County, Anahuac and Winnie are close by. Those are 20, 30 minutes away. And at Smith Point, there's a hawk watch tower, and it is unbelievable to stand there. Now, if you want to see swallowtail kite, you would have gone three weeks ago. That's when they really peak. But if you go now and next week, and any date of September from here on out, you can see lots of broad-winged hawks going over. And it's fantastic.
All right. And let's close out this month with our conservation tip. What do you have for us this month?
Okay. Have you ever thought about all the forest habitat forever sunk under Toledo Bend Reservoir on the Texas-Louisiana border? Ivory-billed woodpeckers once frequented those bottomland hardwood forests. And consider the downstream need for fresh water into the Gulf of Mexico. Fresh water from rainfall that flows down our rivers and bayous unimpeded by dams, and eventually finding its way to the Gulf. Numerous species require such freshwater inflows, like blue crabs that wintering whooping cranes feed on, or the Gulf shrimp industry that's tough to beat on the dinner table. So I'm gonna focus this conservation tip on two biggies in the world of water conservation. First, leaky pipes. I could rattle off all sorts of reports that estimate how many gallons are lost due to leaky pipes, but instead, just make it a point to get any leak at home or office fixed immediately, because those gallons of wasted water accumulate rapidly. Second, automatic lawn sprinklers. If you have one at home or office, don't set it to automatically come on, and don't trust that rain sensor that could fail at any time. Instead, set your sprinklers manually, ensuring that the yard truly needs watering when you decide to flip that switch on by hand. Encourage your lawn to grow deeper roots by not overwatering. Those deeper roots will help find more moisture underground instead of the grass that grows shallow roots because there's an oversupply of sprinkler water. Your lawn and your pocketbook can afford to go on such a diet plan. Also, use native plants on your property since they use less water. If we all viewed water as our lifeblood, as we should, we wouldn't casually watch as it's wasted. The human body cannot make it a half a week without clean drinking water. So conserve water to save money, but also do it for the birds.
Okay, so, and not only that, for the rest of our ecology, since
right.
as we have noticed, as I said, I was in Florida for 20 years, which at one time it was considered you'll never run out of water. And now they're struggling to find enough water to serve all of the population and everything else
That's
in
right.
the area. So
That's
water
right.
conservation is very important. So, well, Cliff, I want to thank you again for joining us once again for Bird Calls and coming in all the way from deep in the heart of Texas, deep in the Piney Woods there.
Happy to make the trip.
You have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford. He is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We'd like to thank everybody who called in tonight, and also the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for sharing Cliff with us. And I personally want to thank Cliff again for coming in and doing this show. Bird Calls is made possible by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. The producers for this show are Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with help from Wally Derleth, Tim Schnell, Judy Cox, and Dee Dooley tonight. The audio from tonight's program will be posted on our website in the next few hours, and you can listen to this program again on our website at redriverradio.org. Stay tuned. We have Radio Lab coming up next here on Red River Radio. And on Tuesday, October 18th, we'll have our next edition of What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden. And Cliff will be back in November on November 15th at 6 p.m. for our next edition of Bird Calls. You are listening to Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. Stay tuned. Radio Lab coming up in just a moment, followed by New Orleans Calling.